Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no.
Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And tonight, I am fortunate to have a co-host, Jessie Bouchain. Hello. Okay, there you are. You're on now. Hello.
Hi there.
And let me also say before we continue that the views and opinions that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and my co-host, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Today, my guests are Susanna Clark and Hunter Drohojowska Phelps. First up is Susanna Clark. Susanna was born in Nottingham, England in 1959, the eldest daughter of a Methodist minister. She was educated at St. Hilda's College, Oxford, and has worked in various areas of nonfiction publishing. In 1990, she left London to teach English in Turin and Bilbao. She returned to England in 1992 and spent the rest of that year in the county Durham, where she began work on Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. From 1993 to 2003, Susanna Clark was an editor at Simon & Schuster's Cambridge office, where she worked on their cookbook list. She's published a number of short stories and novellas in American anthologies, and we're very happy to have her with us here today to talk about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Oh, what a wonderful book you have written, and gosh, I don't think I've read a bad review, which is just really incredible, I think, for your book. Will you talk a bit about it and how it came about?
Well, as you say, in the early 90s, I was teaching English as a foreign language, and in 1992, I was in Bilbao in northern Spain, and I'd tried to write a number of novels before, and I was then working on a very bad detective novel which didn't have a plot, so I gave up. And I effectively gave up trying to write. But it happened that I wasn't very well at that time, and I was having to rest up a lot. So I reread Tolkien in order to kill the boredom. And it just brought it all back to me, how much I loved magic and fantasy. Those were the books that, when I was younger, I'd really loved. And so when I'd finished rereading it, I thought that what I ought to do is to try and write one myself, and to sort of bring together all the aspects of all the books that I'd loved. And somehow out of that concoction, I got Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Interesting. Jessie.
Hi, Susanna.
Hi.
I'm loving your book. I'm about halfway through. And you mentioned Tolkien. One of the things I just love about his books, and also C.S. Lewis, which I've noticed that you mentioned in the interview on your website, is that the weather is such a character in both books. And I noticed in your own as well that winter and the soggy weather is just so much a part of your book.
Yeah, I realized when I finished writing the book that I had an almost 800-page novel in which almost all the scenes, not quite all, but almost all the scenes take part at place at winter. Winter is a favorite season of mine, and I just think it adds drama to almost any scene. Whether it's whether people are indoors or out, it's very often winter.
Interesting. I'm curious whether you did any sort of conventional plotting or outlining with Jonathan Strange, or did you write it in scenes? And I don't know, what was your process with it?
What happened was, first of all, I began with the characters, the two central characters, the two magicians, who are their relationship, which is a rather tortuous one, being very different characters, but being the only two men in England, in Britain at the time, who could do practical magic, and the way that throws them together, but the way their characters pull them apart. And from that, the book sort of evolved from that relationship. And then from fairly early on, I had a very, very rough outline in my mind, a sort of blocked out, almost a visual image in my mind of where it would be dark and where it would be light and where things would be going well for people and where things would be going disastrously. And I also had an idea of the note on which the book would end, you know, whether things were going well for the characters or badly at that point, and how the world would be at that point. But I had very little notion of the exact plot devices which would get me to those places. And so I generally know in detail about 3 or 4 chapters ahead, I guess, what's going to happen, and everything beyond that, with the exception of a few bright moments of clarity, everything beyond that is a bit vague.
Interesting.
To that point, Susanna, I was wondering, I really loved the use of footnotes in this book, and I was really drawn in as a reader with these sort of proofs, the primary and secondary sources, and the stories within a story. And I was wondering, in your use of footnotes, how much you planned ahead there? How much you knew of the backstory when you started?
I didn't know when I began that I was going to use footnotes. But I did have all this history which underpins the novel. The main narrative is set in the early 1800s, but the England at the beginning of the book it seems very similar to the England we've known. But in medieval times, it's been very different. When my very, very early notes for this book, I was writing the medieval story and the later story in tandem, and it could have gone either way as to which I would focus on. I decided to go with the later story. And then I discovered that with footnotes, I could build up tiny pictures of what life had been like in the medieval England, and how with a population of fairies and magicians, it had been quite different. And no, I didn't exactly plan each one. In fact, in the footnotes, I felt freer. I felt freer to write little stories. Everything that I wrote there had less consequences than the main narrative. So they were a great relief in some ways from writing the narrative.
Susanna, will you read to us?
Absolutely.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and we're here with Susanna Clark, author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Right. In this passage, Jonathan Strange, the magician, has been longing to see a fairy, longing to find a fairy to help him with his magic, which he thinks will make a big difference. He's never seen one. But certain events have led him to believe that there might be a link between madness and seeing fairies. And he has found himself a mad lady, Mrs. Delgado, who lives with 50 cats and who cannot relate to people anymore, but only cats. And she has a dead mouse in a saucer, which looks suspiciously like her dinner. And he thinks that he can do something with this. Strange began to say a spell. There was a burst of silver lights in the room. It was something between white flames and the glittering effect which fireworks produce. For a moment it hung in the air between Mrs. Delgado and Strange. Then Strange made a gesture as if he intended to throw it at her. The light flew towards her, and just for a moment she was bathed in a silver radiance. Suddenly Mrs. Delgado was nowhere to be seen, and in her place was a solemn, sulky girl in an old-fashioned gown. Then the girl, too, disappeared, to be replaced by a beautiful young woman with a willful expression. She was followed swiftly by an older woman of imperious bearing, but with a glint of impending madness in her eyes. All the women Mrs. Delgado had ever been flickered for an instant in the chair. Then all of them disappeared. On the chair was only a heap of crumpled silk. Out of it stepped a little grey cat. The cat jumped daintily down, sprang up on the windowsill, and vanished into the darkness. "Well, that worked," said Strange. He picked up the half-rotten dead mouse by its tail. Instantly, he became interesting to several of the cats who mewed and purred and rubbed themselves against his legs to attract his attention. He grimaced. And what was John Usclass forced to endure, I wonder, in order to forge English magic? He wondered if he would notice any difference. Would he find, after he had done the spell, that he was trying to guess if he were mad now? Would he stand about, trying to think mad thoughts to discover if any of them seem more natural? He took a last look around at the world, opened his mouth, and gingerly lowered the mouse into it.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and that was Susanna Clark reading from Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Susanna, I have a question about the book's sort of literary leanings. I was wondering, much has been made of the book's potential for introducing the adult literary reading world to fantasy as a literary fantasy, and I was wondering if you had a sense of this when you were writing it. Was that your intention to open these roads, so to speak?
I think it occurred to me that this might be possible, but it seemed such a very tall order. I think fantasy in the sort of after Rowling, after Pullman, and all the other writers who've come along, fantasy is definitely becoming more respectable, and more people, adult readers, are finding a taste for it. But I think, for me, when I was writing, it would be truer to say that I really wasn't thinking very much in terms of genre at all, whether literary genre or fantasy genre or any other. I was simply, in many ways, I was writing the book. For me, I was writing the book that I wanted to read. And I think almost, to me, it seems that genres are what publishers and booksellers need to concern themselves with, because they need to explain the books to other people. They need to say, it's like this, it's not like that. But I think for writers and readers, we can afford to ignore questions of genre, because when the reader gets the book in her or his hands, then she or he can make up their own minds about it.
Mm-hmm. Are you at all surprised about the warm reception for this book? It is, you know, it has become so loved by so many. And it, for those of you who haven't seen Jonathan Strange yet, it's 782 pages. It's a big book. And, you know, and these are the days of shorter and shorter novels. And it's really caused quite a stir. Has that surprised you?
It's amazed me. it's been absolutely astonishing. It's been helped a bit by the fact that it's been growing from quite an early stage. It's always been slightly bigger than I expected it to. My publisher's reception of me when I first went to meet them was very enthusiastic, and I was surprised how many of the people in the company had read the book. And then in June, I came over to Chicago for the Booksellers Association Expo, and I met a lot of booksellers there who seemed really enthusiastic. So, and now readers seem really enthusiastic, and it's wonderful, and it is surprising, and extremely gratifying.
I'm curious about something that I read that you said, something to the effect of, you said that what happened when you were writing Jonathan Strange is the world changed in your favor.
Yeah.
Would you elaborate?
When I started, this was before J.K. Rowling had published any Harry Potter book, and before anyone, I think Philip Pullman had published some books, but he wasn't known for the, he hadn't yet published his Dark Materials. So as far as I knew, I was, you know, I was alone in my taste for magic and magicians, and I wasn't expecting that there was this big, there was no big adult audience for these sorts of books. That didn't deter me because I was sort of writing to find out what happened rather than writing for a market. But while I was writing, Harry Potter happened, Philip Pullman happened, and my mother was constantly saying to me, you know, you better hurry up and finish. All of this will be over by the time you're ready.
Susanna, I wanted to ask you about the names of your characters. I just found them totally charming. And as I was reading the book, there were times when I would come across someone new and just figured you must have had so much fun doing it. The Mr. Honeyfoot and God Bless and Drawlight and Childermass. And I'm so curious about these names. Tell us something about them.
I think at the beginning they were very much. I was very much taking my cue from Charles Dickens and creating these made-up, rather fanciful names. Honeyfoot is definitely a made-up name. I can't actually remember if Childermass is or not at this stage. It might possibly be a real name. I'm not sure. And choosing them was, as you say, great fun. And I tried to give a sense of period with some of the older magicians in choosing the names, and that was good fun too. By the end, I'd just in my research for this book, I'd become more aware that Britain, that England at that time was a country of regions. Regional differences were much stronger then than they are now. And so by the end, when I was choosing new names for characters, I tended to try and choose appropriately regional ones for where the character came from.
Well, to that, I'm so curious about early 19th century England and the language, the colloquialisms. Did you have to do a lot of research, or did you just read a lot of Jane Austen and sort of just absorb it, or Dickens?
Mostly the latter. I mean, for the sort of well-to-do characters, of who are in this book probably the majority, the people who are quite who have servants and are quite rich, there is no better guide to the way people spoke, I think, than Jane Austen. I mean, I did read other things, but I just find her language so enthralling, and she's a great guide to the way people used grammar, which was slightly different. The way they used vocabulary is slightly different. And very often in reading her, you realize that it's not as people suppose with period, the dialogue of this period. It's not that the language was more ornate. It's actually more precise than we use it now. For the lower class characters, again, they were just spoken with their regional variations. So yes, sometimes I did look at regional dialects, but that is such a big area that I could only do that fairly superficially.
Sure. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Susanna Clark, author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Jesse Bruchain. I wanted to talk a little bit about research, and what sort of research did you do for the book? And did you do it before you started writing, or was it concurrent, you know, as you were writing the book?
I wouldn't have known how to do it if I'd had to do it before, because at that point I didn't really know what I needed to know.
Yes.
So I actually did quite a bit of writing before I did any research at all, and then I sort of looked at it, and because this is really the book on which I learnt to write, so some of my ideas at the beginning of how to do it were completely nuts. But when I realised I had to do research, I started very simply with the political history, which was tough and not at all my favourite, and then I expanded into researching social history, and I kind of did two sorts of research. I did the research that I knew I needed for specific events and specific themes, and then I just did whatever caught my fancy, things that I just sort of had an intuitive feeling might have a connection with the book, and sometimes I was right and sometimes I was wrong, but sometimes these sorts of things really fed the narrative in surprising ways.
Well, as to that, I'm curious about something that you said in your interview on the website about how your writing style is sort of process and stream of consciousness, and you had so much research as well. So how did you juggle that? I'm really curious about that process.
Although I did them concurrently, I probably kept the research that I was doing for a particular chapter and the chapter writing a little bit distant in time from each other, just so that in a way the research could kind of settle into my brain and not be, you know, all fresh and there at the front. The only time when I felt that the research was really in danger of taking over the narrative was in the very last chapter I wrote, which is not the last chapter in the book. It's a middle chapter, and that's the chapter on Waterloo. And so you have to do quite a lot of specific research there, because there's a lot which is known about that battle and where everybody was at particular points in the day and what was happening. And I just discovered so many great stories, so many either touching or heart-rending or human, funny stories that happened, that it was very difficult, actually, not to go on writing that chapter. It's a long chapter, but it could have been a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. What is it about writing about a different century? You're writing about the early 19th century. And apparently you're doing that for your next book?
Yeah.
What is it about that, about being in another century so long ago?
That's a difficult question. I don't really know. I just feel very at home and comfortable there. It's partly the romance of the past. I try not to idealize it too much because, I mean, there was obviously great hardship. You know, nobody had electricity. Life could be pretty tough. But I think I do find it in many ways. I don't know I want to live there, but it's an attractive place to visit. The countryside was more beautiful. People socialized more. I think the very sort of the precise forms of behavior are quite attractive to us. Again, you might not want to live that in your own life, but it's quite enjoyable to explore. I think it's to do with that. And it's also, as a writer, I think, going back to a past time and looking at things almost down the wrong end of a telescope, it's easier to sift through stuff in a way. I mean, the contemporary world is all around us, and there's too much stuff for a writer to select what she's going to write about necessarily. Perhaps that distance of time just makes it a bit easier. It seems calmer.
Hmm. Also, you apparently were involved in nonfiction quite a bit before, before Jonathan Strange. How did you know you had this novel in you? What was happening?
I'd always wanted to write write fiction from my teenage years, I think, or even before. Books played a huge part in my childhood. I read a lot. And so really from about the time I was a student at university, I was trying to write. And there was always something that I was trying to write, but nothing ever got finished until I got to Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Interesting. We are at the end of our time, Susanna. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening.
I think my advice probably comes down to two small things. And one is that I highly recommend Dorothea Brand's Becoming a Writer. She's an American creative writer teaching in the 1930s,
yes.
I think, or if not 20s. And I found her book more helpful, a great deal more helpful than anything else. She's a great one for writing every day and not letting the editor intrude, but letting your creative part of the brain just write. And I find her book is one that published authors continually go back to. I've spoken to people about it. And the other thing is, and this worked for me, I don't know if it would work for everybody, but that is simply to read the things you love. Don't let people dictate to you what people ought to be reading now. Read the things that you really enjoy and write the things that you really enjoy, and something will come out of that.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Susanna.
It's been wonderful talking to you.
I've enjoyed it greatly. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. That was Susanna Clark, author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, published by Bloomsbury, speaking to us from San Francisco, where she is on book tour. And there is a website. What is the website, Jess?
It's www.jonathanstrange.com.
And is there tour information on there?
I don't know if there's tour information, but there are interviews. There's actually a video interview, which is wonderful. All kinds of things. There's actually Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell's responses to the book, their reviews.
Oh, really?
Both of which
I haven't seen them.
Are funny to read. They're great to read.
I'm looking just to see where she is next. She's in San Francisco. Well, she was this afternoon. Tonight she's in Berkeley, Menlo Park, San Mateo. Does she come back down this way? No, she doesn't. But she'll be up and down the West Coast. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera on the 26th. And that's they have a website, Book Passage does. So anyway, thank you to Jess for being here.
Quite a treat.
Stay tuned. When we come back, we will be with Hunter. I hope I get this last name right. Drohojaska Philp, author of Full Bloom, The Art and Life of Georgia O'Keeffe. Please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing. We are at 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are back with our next guest, Hunter Drahojowska Philp, author of Full Bloom, The Art and Life of Georgia O'Keeffe. Hello, Hunter.
Hello, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I was intrigued with Full Bloom from the moment I read an excerpt in the LA Times a few weeks ago. Will you talk a bit about how the idea for the book came about and your particular slant on Georgia O'Keeffe?
Well, it all started ever so long ago when I wrote an obituary of O'Keeffe for Art News magazine. And in the course of doing that, I realized that in 1987, there really wasn't very much of great depth about this famous artist. There had been one biography written by Lori Lyle, and it had been written over O'Keeffe's strenuous objections, so it couldn't go into a lot of areas. So I wrote a proposal, and I got a contract, and off we went to write this book. And here I am, almost 20 years later, the real tortoise in the Tortoise and Hare saga about a George O'Keeffe book. Other biographies have been written, and what I really had to do was wait and do more research and do yet more research until finally a book could be written that would fill in a lot of the gaps that that hadn't been filled by previous work.
Mm.
So the slant, if, as it were, is that there are several slants, but one of them is that I really wanted to try and get past the myth that O'Keeffe built up around herself and try to find out more about the woman who created the myth.
Yeah. So it sounds like you did a ton of research before you did any writing. Is that so?
I did a lot of research. I was very fortunate to be able to interview Dorothy Norman, who was the mistress of Alfred Stieglitz and the woman who really came between Alfred Stieglitz and George O'Keeffe, Alfred Stieglitz being George O'Keeffe's husband. And then she also gave me permission to read the correspondence, the letters that she had written to Alfred Stieglitz and that he had written to her, which were sealed, although they are housed at the Beinecke Library at Yale. And I had that information, and I also had read all the letters that O'Keeffe had written to Paul Strand. But I felt like it really wasn't quite enough. I felt like we needed to go. I had written one version of this book, and then I discovered that the catalog Raisonné was about to come out. That was in 1998. And when that came out, there were over 1,000 works by O'Keeffe that were unknown to anybody, really. Works on paper, pastels, abstractions. And it just gave me and anyone who was interested in Georgia O'Keeffe's art a much fuller view of what she produced in her lifetime. And I thought I really had to go back and rewrite the whole book for many reasons. One was to incorporate this information, also just to make it extremely accurate in terms of the dating and the chronology. All previous biographies are in some way inaccurate just because people didn't have access to the correct information. So this was a great boon. And then in the meantime, more people passed away, and their letters went to various libraries, and so more information started to come into the book. And so I really think that it was better to wait. I didn't think we needed another George O'Keeffe book that was superficial.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what you just said, having access to the correct information, how do you know it's correct? I mean, do you have to put it through, an amount of fact-checking? Or what do you do with information once you get it for a biography?
There's the hard data of when the paintings were painted, like what year. That was the purpose of really the catalog Raisonné. You know, now we know exactly when she painted which abstract paintings, and then that sheds some light on what she was doing that year. And so that was easy. In terms of the correct information, what I like to rely on is correspondence and primary sources. I relied a lot on the correspondence because that is how those people felt at that point in time. And I just spent months and months at a table in the Beinecke Library reading virtually all the letters that these people wrote to one another. And they were all great letter writers, Stieglitz and O'Keefe and all of their friends. So I think I gained a pretty accurate picture of the ambience of the time. And, of course, most of them are dated. And if they're not dated, the researchers of the Beinecke have tried to date them. And then I also went to the Center for Creative Photography at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where they have the Paul Strand archive, where George O'Keefe wrote all those letters to Paul Strand.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking today with Hunter Drohodyalska Phelps, author of Full Bloom. Speaking of letters, as you were talking about their correspondence, I suddenly thought of email and what's going to happen to future biographers with you know, no access to letters because of all the correspondence over email.
Well, exactly, and this is a topic that is discussed often among biographers. I mean, it will fundamentally change the nature of that field. I mean, how can we really know?
Right.
Those letters are so valuable to us because they are just so amazingly revealing. Obviously, the people who are writing these letters often didn't think that anyone ever would read them. Certainly when George O'Keefe is writing to her girlfriend, Anita, about her feelings about making art when she's, you know, out in South Carolina making her first abstract drawings and paintings. I mean, she never dreams these expressions are going to be read or published decades later after she's been a famous artist. So they're very fresh, and we won't know about those. I do know, in answer to your question about the email, I know people who save emails from their friends.
Yes.
So that might be a frightening thought for some of their friends, but I know that writers who communicate with other writers and get a particularly moving letter from them, they print it out and save it as if it were a hand-penned letter.
Yeah, we must do that. Well, you know, I was looking through your book and thinking that in writing a biography, and just now I was looking through because I've been reading it, but there is the subject, the person you're writing about, and then there's the biographer, and how much of yourself can you put into a biography? I mean, you have... from what I can see, you've kept yourself out of it, and what is here of you is your lovely writing style and the story of Georgia O'Keefe. But is that a conscious, very conscious act to keep yourself out of it?
Yes, and not everybody likes that style. It is my style. I try to sort of get myself out of the way so that the focus will be on whatever O'Keefe is doing. And sometimes I'm sure it's almost sort of too straightforward. I worry that I've been sort of too restrained and in parts. But I didn't want to do anything flowery, if you'll excuse the pun, about George O'Keefe's work, because in reading a lot, there is a lot of kind of over the top enthusiasm for O'Keefe as an artist, as a person. And certainly I didn't feel she needed a champion. I feel as though she has always had lots of champions. And what I felt like she needed was someone to try to explain what happened and how she went from being this young girl to being a school teacher in Texas, or to back up a bit, her family losing its money, her having to go to work, her moving to Texas and working as a school teacher, and this fluke, complete fluke, whereby her drawings wind up in the hands of the most prominent art dealer of 1918, Alfred Stieglitz, and her getting a show, even though she's nobody, excuse me, I should back up, 1916, meeting him in 1918, becoming his lover, having him leave his wife, against all odds in 1918, just the likelihood of that, this man being willing to leave his marriage of 25 years for this 31-year-old school teacher is another fluke. So I really wanted to kind of try to get as close to the story of these extraordinary things that happened to this woman in her life, and not overwhelm that with my own opinions. I obviously have my opinions in there, but my own flowery descriptions or something.
Yeah.
It makes any sense.
It does make sense, and you've done such a great job at doing that. Will you read to us?
I beg your pardon?
Will you read to us?
Well, I can read from the introduction, which is where I sort of outline what I was trying to do. And sometimes that might give people an idea of the structure of the book, if you'd like.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to read from I'm going to read from parts of the introduction. George O'Keeffe may be the best known and least understood artist of the 20th century. She was a woman who lived the newspaper's adage that if the myth is more stirring than the truth, print the myth. Nonetheless, I have attempted an honest portrayal of the woman and behind the myth, exploring her remarkable strengths and talents, as well as the demons and dark past that occasionally drove her to behave cruelly. In her idealized autobiography, titled simply Georgia O'Keeffe, she described her early childhood on a Sun Prairie, Wisconsin farm as idyllic. The truth is that her parents were not happily married, and bad decisions made by her father proved to be disastrous to the welfare of the family. Her father lost the substantial fortune built up by his parents and his in-laws. As a result, shortly after the turn of the century, when families were less migratory than today, O'Keeffe was forced to move three times during high school. These moves were followed by study at two colleges in two different states. The combination of geographical upheaval and her family's loss of income left O'Keeffe in Chicago at the age of 20 with little hope of becoming an artist. Instead, she worked long hours as a freelance illustrator for minuscule pay. Scattered dreams, piecemeal education, and poverty. This is not the picture painted in O'Keeffe's own autobiography.
Thank you. That was Hunter Drohojowska Phelps reading from Full Bloom. Why didn't she include that, do you think?
O'Keeffe really had an unusual opportunity at the end, in the second half of her life. Her husband, the photographer and art dealer Alfred Stieglitz, died in 1946, and after settling his estate, as we know, she moved to New Mexico. But what she learned from Alfred Stieglitz was how to control and manipulate the image of who she was. Now, until then, Alfred had controlled and manipulated her image. Without him, it was her responsibility to do that for herself. And I go to some lengths in the book to show how she did that. And part of that, of course, was publishing her autobiography in 1976, where she basically, it's a memoir of the high points of her life. And one of the more interesting parts of that book is that she hardly even mentions Alfred Stieglitz. It is my belief that as a sort of revenge for the fact that he went off with Dorothy Norman, although they continued to be, O'Keeffe and Stieglitz continued to be husband and wife, she more or less erased him from her story. Instead of writing in her memoir about how much she loved Alfred Stieglitz, how helpful he'd been to her in her career, how he taught her to be a professional artist, she mentions him a few times kind of in passing as though he were just, you know, another friend. And I thought that was so interesting. And I also thought it was interesting that at the end of her life, I mean, really the way we know O'Keeffe today, we think of her as a strong, sort of weather-beaten, iconic figure living alone in the desert, wearing her black kimono jacket. And we know that because she was photographed by dozens of famous photographers. And She controlled those photo sessions with Cecil Beaton and with Horst and with Todd Webb and Felice Halsman and Bruce Weber and Laura Gilpin. She knew everything about posing and controlling the photographic moment. So we really know that we know Georgia O'Keeffe as she wanted us to know her. She knew the difference between being a public professional artist and keeping her private life, her personal life, separate from that. So everyone thinks, I mean, many people today actually think that she was an artist from New Mexico. I've been giving lectures around the country, and numerous people say they did not know about her early New York years, which I find surprising, but that's how strongly she managed to manifest her will for how she should look in perpetuity or for history.
Yes, interesting. How did you choose what to include and what to leave out?
Well, I probably will be accused of not leaving out enough. It is a very full bloom, and I don't think you'd want it any fuller. But I wanted a really complete sense of each year and each period. So what wound up on the cutting room floor are probably more of the Dorothy Norman, Alfred Stieglitz story wound up getting edited. I had quite a few letters from her and from him quoted in the book, and my editor felt that we were getting sidetracked. We were almost going down a different storyline. You know, we had lost track of O'Keeffe, and we were getting very involved in the love affair between Alfred and Dorothy. So a lot of that really wound up being taken out. And I got very interested in, a few years before the book came out, Maria Chabot died. And Maria had lived with O'Keeffe from 1941 to 1949 and had really built the home in Abiquiu that is now open to the public, and it's the most famous of O'Keeffe's two homes in New Mexico. And she had many letters from O'Keeffe and many letters to O'Keeffe, and those became available after her death. So for the first time ever, those are included in the book, but I couldn't include as many as I might otherwise have liked to, because I think they're very interesting in terms of the way they explain what life was like for these two women living in the desert in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the 1940s. And So things had to be pared away if they were taking us away from really the essence of Georgia O'Keeffe's story. That's what I had to leave behind.
Interesting. Did you know what you were after when you started this biography? Did you know what you were looking for, or were you kind of like Columbo? I mean, were you like Columbo in that way, or was it a process of discovery?
I think I don't know other biographers, but for me it was certainly a process of discovery. And the interesting thing is that biographers can write different books about the same person. I can go read a stack of letters and come to conclusions about that material that another biographer might miss altogether, just because each of us brings a whole basket of information to what we're reading, not only in terms of our O'Keeffe research, but our whole life experience. So I did think it was a process of discovery, and that was actually my favorite part, putting the pieces together of this jigsaw puzzle, but you didn't even actually know what the jigsaw puzzle was going to represent. And I thought it was very important to try to keep an open mind about what I was finding. A good example is the Dorothy Norman material. It had been known. It is in other biographies, but some biographers have said that there was no sexual relationship between Dorothy Norman and Alfred Stieglitz, and others have said it wasn't very important. But because I had access to all this correspondence, I was able to see that it was important. But for a long time, I wasn't sure. For a long time, I doubted myself. I thought, well, if it were really important, somebody else would have discovered it by now. And then I thought, no, not necessarily. I had really come across a whole new development in that I had just come across something that other people hadn't wanted to go into for whatever reason, and so I went more deeply into that material, and I really believe that that the more I read it and the more I read about the other correspondence from O'Keefe and Stieglitz and their circle, that this was the cause of her nervous breakdown. She was hospitalized. She didn't paint for 3 years, and when she returns to painting, she has decided to move to New Mexico. And that decision is mostly, in other literature, it's couched as in her love for the Southwest. She had to leave Alfred Stieglitz, but I had to think, actually, here's a woman whose husband's having an affair, and he refuses to stop having an affair, and they both live in the same town. And so somebody's going to have to move. And O'Keefe decided it would be her.
It's true. I was surprised by that in your book. Because I recall reading about Georgia O'Keefe years ago and her move. And she was going for artistic purposes to get out of the city. And I found that really surprising.
I think that people in general for years now have not wanted to let go of the idea of O'Keefe and Stieglitz as the great American love story of the art world. And it's a very powerful story. You know, they meet in 1918. He makes her career. She renews his photography. They're madly in love. He takes these wonderful photographs of her naked. She becomes a star. And it's hard to... I don't think people really want to think about the fact that at the height of this creative symbiosis, he loses interest in his creation and runs off with a younger woman. It's just very disheartening, really.
Yeah.
And it so undermines this idea we have of O'Keefe and Stieglitz. But I did think this book had to really get out of that O'Keefe-Stieglitz sort of little tight ball or something. I thought the reason I called it Full Bloom is that I wanted it to be a book that had the period of her life before Stieglitz, during Stieglitz, and after Stieglitz. I wanted to encompass the entire 98 years of her life and to give a sense of her, of a woman who lived a long, creative, full life with boyfriends before Stieglitz, a love affair, the love of her life with Stieglitz, the heartbreak of losing Stieglitz, and then doing what would have been very difficult at the time, really recreating herself anew in New Mexico. And this, of course, is decades before we think of, you know, today we think of people self-actualizing in therapy, you know, women taking care of themselves and learning to take care of their own feelings and be their own best friend and being their own husband. We have all that kind of psychobabble language for it, you know. But Georgia O'Keefe was alone. She didn't have a role model. She was the role model. She didn't have girlfriends who would tell her that she was doing the right thing. She had to do it on her own. And I think that I found that very moving, and I had a lot of empathy for that. And it also gave me some insight into how she became sort of a tough woman,
mm-hmm.
as she got older, a little hardened, a little impatient. I think that going through those kinds of battles leaves scars.
Yeah. Oh, we have another minute or two left with Hunter Drohojowska Philp, author of Full Bloom, The Art and Life of Georgia O'Keefe, published by Norton. And wanted to ask you real quick about the selling of the book. Did you go the traditional route of book proposal, or what happened?
I have an agent who took my proposal and sold it and then ultimately it got finished and here we are.
Here we are. Gosh.
The world's longest book process. It isn't the longest. It isn't the longest. Biographies often take a really long time. I mean, I think the minimum is 5 to 7 years.
How long did this take?
And people really, I've gotten a lot of encouragement from other biographers who say, don't despair. This is long, but it's not unheard of. You know, we have we have there are precedents, and so I feel a little comforted. Obviously, I didn't work on it the whole time. I as you know, I write freelance for a lot of publications. I had an academic position for many years, but the fact is that by waiting longer, and it did sink in at a very deep level, and I hope that comes out in the book. I hope it feels like a really solid book.
It does feel like a solid book. I find it quite wonderful. And as I said, I'm learning things I had no idea, and my view of Georgia O'Keeffe is shifting. So that's interesting. That's really quite interesting.
Well, I'm hoping that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. Any last words for the writers listening, perhaps writers interested in biography?
Well, I do think you have to find a subject with whom you want to live, someone who's going to have enough of a life there to keep you interested for a long time, and to pick something feasible, you know, to pick somebody who, I mean, at least I had an artist who had a lot of, there was a lot of material to work with. You know, there were letters, and there were lots of people who knew her. So, in a way, all those were very helpful. I would suggest, as my husband has often said to me, that next time pick someone who didn't live quite so long. I mean, someone said they thought the book was too long, and I said, well, she lived it for 100 years.
Yeah, really.
So it's really only 50 pages a decade.
I don't think it's too long.
It's like, you know, if you pick someone who lives 100 years, you have to kind of, it has to be a little bit long.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. That was Hunter Drohojowska Philp, author of Full Bloom, the story of George O'Keeffe, which is a wonderful story, and there's many discoveries in this book. So if you're at all interested in George O'Keeffe or interested in her art, I think this book you will find interesting. I can't say more. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly list. And you can read all about Pen on Fire, which I'm not going to even say any more about it because it's my book and I'm not allowed to talk about it on my show because it's my show. Isn't that weird? That makes sense, sort of. No self-promotion. I want to leave you, though, with a quote by Gertrude Stein, who said, "Nobody knows what I am trying to do, but I do, and I know when I succeed." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week. How many tears, my darling, must a girl let fall? How many years will it take